Hello and welcome to New Netherland Praatjes, a series of chats on the Dutch colony of New Netherland, brought to you by the New Netherland Institute and the New Netherland Research Center in Albany, New York. Praatjes is Dutch for chat, and these are informal conversations with historians, archaeologists, and other experts on the world of the 17th century Dutch. Hello, welcome to another edition of New Netherland Praatjes. My name is Russell Shorto. Today we are in-house. We are speaking with Dr. Jani Venema from the famous or infamous 8th floor of the New York State Library, where she has her office and where she has worked since 1980.
On the 8th floor I have worked
well,
since...
Well, in the building.
In the building I've worked since 1984.
84
was as a volunteer,
uh-huh.
And officially since 1985, uh-huh. February 1985. Uh-huh.
Let me just give a little biographical information before we get into those details. Jani was born in Nijeveen in the province of Drenthe in the Netherlands. She studied at Groningen University in the Netherlands and then taught Dutch and history at a high school in Haarlem. That is the Dutch Haarlem, of course. After moving to the U.S. in 1985, it says here, but maybe 84, she began working with the New Netherland Project, now known as the New Netherland Research Center, where she is currently associate director. A short version of her master's thesis from the State University of New York at Albany on poor relief in Beverwijk and early Albany was published in the Netherlands in 1993. In 2003, she received a PhD from the Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam. Her dissertation, Beverwijk, a Dutch village on the American frontier, later published as a book, describes the founding of Albany. Her second book, published in 2010, is Killian van Rensselaer, Designing a New World, and it examined van Rensselaer's role as a driving force behind the peopling of New Netherland and his motivations for colonization. Jani, we were, so you just, let's do a little bit of biographical now, a little bit of background. So talk about... let's just go all the way back. You were born and raised on a farm in Drenthe, yes?
I was, and we still have the farm.
Uh-huh.
It's up for sale now, but we still have it, and that's where I spend part of my summer.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I went to elementary school. I went to high school in Meppel, and then I did a teacher's college in Meppel.
Give us a picture, paint a picture of what it's like, what it was like growing up on a farm in the eastern part of the Netherlands. I think shortly after we met, you told me that you actually wore klompen. She wore wooden shoes.
Yeah. I grew up on them. And uh-huh. They are great in the winter because they keep your feet warm.
Uh-huh.
You can also, when the streets are iced, you can slide on them.
And they're good for walking in mud, is that right?
Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah. I also used them when I was living in Averill Park and I had a huge garden.
Wow.
And I wore out 3 pairs of them. And then when you have holes in the bottom, then you put newspapers on.
Wow.
On the bottom of the inside.
Yeah.
And then you can still wear them like for a couple of weeks.
And so Dutch farm children wore them.
In my childhood,
yes. In your childhood, they did. Still. Yeah.
I don't know if they still
wear
them.
No, I mean, it's still at least as recently as that. People still wore them. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What did they do in the farm? Was your father, did he raise crops?
We had both a little bit. When I was very little, we had crops. And then later, we only had cows.
Uh-huh.
And it was nice, I think. Although, I felt always kind of bad being a farmer's child because I looked up at people who had a very small burgerhuisje.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought those people were really important, and mm-hmm. I felt like they were much more important. And of course, we had a big farm, and all the kids in my class, they came play at our house because we had a lot of space. But it was still, I don't know. I just thought you were important if you had like a house with maybe 2 living houses under 1 cap or so. So, yeah, I looked up at those people.
You then went to university and you studied history?
I was in, no, actually, when I did a teacher's college first that gave me certification to teach or to be a principal of an elementary school. And after that, I studied Dutch in, that was a different teacher's college. It was very experimental at the time. So I got my main degree in Dutch at that college, but you had to also study something else. And then I got a lower degree, a bachelor's level in history. But I never really wanted to do anything with history, but it was at that time you were obligated to pick another study along with Dutch. And I always wanted to study Dutch. And because I loved the language, I loved the grammar, I loved the literature.
And how long did you teach?
I taught for 7.5 to 8 years in Haarlem. And that's I used to teach Dutch only. And then at some point they asked me if I wanted to teach a little bit of history because somebody else had to be laid off otherwise. Then if she could get a few hours of my Dutch classes, then she would not have to be laid off. So, yeah, what are you going to do? So, yeah, that's how I ended up teaching history.
And how was it that you first came to Albany, or were you did you come somewhere else in the U.S.?
No, I first came to Albany. I had an American boyfriend at the time, or I had gotten back in touch with an ex-boyfriend, and he invited me to come over. And I thought, yeah, okay, maybe I had kind of intended to make like a tour of the United States, like my brother had done at the time. I was going to go by Greyhound to the West Coast, from the East Coast to the West Coast. And then that boyfriend picked me up, and I never took the Greyhound bus. We just went by car.
Well, so you did travel around the country with him?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And he lived here in Albany?
He lived in Albany, near Albany. And
so it was just toevallig. It was just it just happened that he lived in Albany, which happens to be kind of the center of...
Well, no, I came actually to the United States at his invitation. But then I thought I'm going to meet with him for like a few days, and then I'm going to continue and go by Greyhound further, and I'll just kind of do it op de bonnefoy, as they say. Yeah. And but then we liked each other that much, and we made the cross country together. But and so that must have been in 1982 or 83, I think.
But what I mean is it's an interesting coincidence that your American boyfriend happened to be in Albany, and Albany is the center of the, you know, this is, you were in the middle of New Netherland.
And I'm
ashamed. I don't know if you knew it at the time.
No, no idea at all, because I'm ashamed to say, but I didn't even know that New York was a state.
Well, sure.
And then I came here, and I saw all those Dutch names like Watervliet and Ganzenvoort and even New Amsterdam. I knew that New York City was New Amsterdam, but that was about as
you
far
didn't
as
know
my
it extended
knowledge.
In up,
no,
up here,
I had no idea at all, and it was funny because. After that one trip, I came back again, and then I met Charlie. And
it, how did you meet Charlie?
Well, it was really funny because I would have met him no matter what. A friend, an other friend of mine here, who I had met in my first trip on vacation, he had taken me around to different places and also to his parents, and the mother had sent me some notes, and she sent me also one time a little newspaper clip about a man who translated Dutch documents into English, and I put it in my backpack. And when I was here the next time, I hadn't really thought about it. And then at some point, my boyfriend had to work, and I had still vacation, of course. So I said, "Well, okay, maybe I'll go to Albany and go to the museum, and you know, those kind of things." And in a museum, I saw one of those old 1655 maps, and it had all these different names on it. Verdrietige Hoek, Spuiten Duivel. And it was kind of fun to see that. And that was the same year when they had asked me to teach history. So I thought, oh my gosh, I should get one of those maps, or at least a copy of it, and mm-hmm. then the kids in my class will think, oh, she's telling about her hiking and about her canoeing and all that, and you know, with all those waterways, and they'll learn a little bit more than what I had learned in high school or had not picked up, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then nobody could really, in the museum shop, they did not have any copies of those maps, and they kind of sent me from one person to another, and then eventually there was one guy, and he said, well, I don't know about those maps, but you can, there is somebody here who knows Dutch, and maybe he knows about those maps too. So then he brought me to Charlie. So, well, meeting Charlie, I mean, it's easy. He's a jovial man, and it was right away easygoing and laughing and chatting. And I said to him, you know, there's somebody else who is doing the same kind of job as you do. And he said, I have no idea who that could be. And I said, well, I have a newspaper clipping, and that is ridiculous that you don't know it. You really should know this person. I'll visit this guy tomorrow, and then I'll get you guys in touch with each other. Needless to say, the next day I was on Charlie's doorstep again, and that was the same as the newspaper clipping. So that was kind of our acquaintance. Yeah. And then, I think after that I came for a leave of absence because I had no idea what to do with the boyfriend at all. I mean, he said to me, well, I can't keep this up going back and forth. And then I kind of decided maybe I should take a leave of absence from my school. So I came here for about 8 months or so. And after a few weeks, I got bored because I couldn't work.
Yeah.
And I called Charlie, and he recognized my voice right away. And he said, Yanni, where are you? And I said, well, I'm here. When are you coming? And I said, oh, I'd rather come today than tomorrow. I only see deer and turtles here. And that's how I started volunteering. So that was in 1984. Uh-huh.
So you started by volunteering with him.
Yeah.
And those days, in the New Netherland Project,
yeah,
was a year-by-year
This was when I first met Charlie. There was just Charlie, and that was on the 11th floor, all the way in the back somewhere, even a much smaller office really than what he had later when you met him first. Uh-huh, uh-huh. It's hardly possible to get it smaller, but it was. And when I had a little bit trouble reading it at first, so I really learned how to transcribe. Well, as a teacher, you get used to different handwritings pretty quickly, so that was not too hard. And of course, in my studies, I had for 5 years, I had a lot of 17th century and medieval Dutch, so the interpretation was not that hard. So it really was just what I loved. Uh-huh. I mean, I just loved those documents.
So he immediately put you to work transcribing the...
He put me to work right away.
Uh-huh. Transcribing the archives of the Colony of New Netherland, the official...
Yeah, yeah. I forgot what the volume was, but I remember that there was one line, and he said, Bruid gij toch naar uw vaar toe? Go to your father. And we talked forever about that one line, and it was just, you know, it kind of tells how it went further, I think. Yeah. We could just, and that's what is so nice about and so great about Charlie, is that he understands all that stuff. I just admire that mm-hmm. so incredibly, that he just feels the language, and for a foreigner, yeah, to be able to know a language like that in depth, and to be able to joke and to really laugh so much about it, it's just fantastic. Uh-huh. So no wonder I got excited about it also on, you know, not just playing for myself, but also working together on
it. But
it obviously
activated your own love of the Dutch language.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. It just made it even stronger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, so you didn't have formal training in deciphering the handwriting?
Not in the paleography.
Right.
No, in interpreting I did, but not in paleography.
Uh-huh. And in the sort of notation, you worked that out in the notation, how you indicate that there are gaps or there are words that are missing, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I just copied it exactly the way it was in the original. And we still, there were no computers yet when I came.
Yeah.
So I transcribed with pencil, which is what Charlie had done before. And I just did it the same way he had always done it.
Legal pads or just in...
I think so, yeah. Legal pads.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then from there, were you involved in the process from beyond transcribing, or you just finished a volume and then went to the next one?
Well, I was transcribing, and then I think things were added on to it. Charlie was working at some point at the Fort Orange Court Minutes, and then he said to me, you know, for the introduction of it, I would really like to have a plan of Beverwijk, Fort Orange, Beverwijk, the village. That's the Beverwijk is the village around Fort Orange. And he said, maybe you can plot that out. Well, I'd never liked history. And I also am not a person who likes games and puzzles at all. And I, but I said, yeah, I'll do that. How difficult can it be? There's a handful of people there. And I said, yeah, I'll try to do that. And then, of course, it was this endless way of figuring out who lived where, because I used existing translations and I used the indexes. And then I would look at the documents and they contradicted all the time. The one time, one person was to the east of so-and-so, and then the next time, it would be to the west of so-and-so. So then I ended up transcribing the originals again, which ended up transcribing 1,368 pages of those documents, which we then later on translated. But this map of Albany was one thing that he asked me to do, and then at the time too, when we were still sitting upstairs in that tiny space, there was also, I had a half-time job transcribing, and there was also an other woman then, Nancy Zeller, who was secretary, and so we kind of started talking about things, and I felt like really, really stupid, because especially in the beginning, because there would come people and they ask something about New Netherland and I had no clue at all. I had no idea what they were asking and I couldn't answer their questions and I just felt so dumb. And then in the other half of my time, I substitute taught at a high school, and I had gotten my certification in America to teach too, but then I felt like, well, I should really maybe get a master's in history so that that certification would be a little bit more stable and based on a master's. So I went to SUNY, and then a Dutch friend of mine said, well, you know, if you go back to the university, maybe you should specialize a little bit more on New Netherland. And of course, that was a good idea because it improved my understanding. And this friend also said, in the deacons in the First Church in Albany, there are all these deacons' account books, and they are beautiful. And maybe you should take a look at that because you like people, and that will give you all kinds of information. So then I ended up doing a whole study about the deacons' accounts, analyzing those. And then, of course, I'm a teacher. I was trained to be a teacher to develop educational material in Groningen in my study time. And so then Nancy and I would make educational packets. She did for the fourth grade, and I did two for the seventh grade. So then you get involved in that. And then I had friends in the Netherlands with who I kept in touch all the time. And when the computers and the internet came, we started figuring, well, gee, we could email with each other if we do something together. So then we had an internet exchange program between two schools, one here in near Albany and one in Wolvergem, where Peter Stuyvesant came from that area. So, and then we did a college exchange too between the Noordelijke Hogeschool, which was the college where I had gone to. It had a different name then, but and the Adirondack Community College. And that exchange program ran for like 12 years or so. So I got involved in all these things because I come from the education world.
Sure. So
and
you
then
brought that.
I'm here from the Netherlands, and in the Netherlands I have my friends, and then here through the high school where I used to substitute, I also knew quite a few people who were interested, and the history teacher there was so interested. And he was the one who went to Adirondack Community College. So there you have the link to those two colleges. And so you kind of run from one thing into another.
Yeah, you very quickly brought those things together.
Yeah, because it was fun to do. And well, and also because I think soon, you know, it took a while. I first moved over here, and the first year or so, I may not have been all that active. But once I started realizing what these papers were really like and what they meant, then I also realized we had to do our fundraising, and Nancy was involved in that. But then when I would go to the Netherlands, I would travel around like a vertegenwoordiger, like a business representative almost, with a bag full of books that had translations of documents. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know how I dared to do this stuff, because I had not really much knowledge at all. But I went to the Heineken people, I went to Unilever, I don't even remember, but we had to raise our own funds.
So you were like a sales rep traveling with your samples. Customers?
We got from Unilever, I think we got like $6,000 for like a period of 5 years or so.
Nice.
And I don't remember more. But
that's
then I also went to people at universities, and they must have thought that I was so dumb, because I went to some professors and I hardly know what I was advertising there. I just kind of wanted to spread the word, I guess. But I just could tell them that it was so important. Mm-hmm. But how it all worked, I'm not sure. So in hindsight, I'm very ashamed of all those trips.
But
I made,
you know, you're young.
I
you have
met.
To just charge out and start doing and learn in the middle
I did.
Of it, right?
Yeah. I remember going by bus to people and it is bag full of books.
Okay, let me back up and ask you, let me just clarify when we're talking about how you were working with Charlie. So the process of of publishing these documents is you're reading these handwritten pages, 17th century Dutch, and then transcription is, well, why don't you take us through the steps? What is transcribing and what happens next?
Yeah, when you begin on a volume, we have different volumes, right? They were categorized at some point, and then we take one volume, and I take the originals, and I transcribe them, which means that I really plain copy them. I typed them into the computer.
Initially, you did it in pencil, but now you type it obviously in a computer.
Yeah. And at the documents are sometimes very badly damaged, like from the fire in 1911. And so sometimes because you have to understand the structure of the sentence, and of course I'm a native Dutchman, Dutch woman, I can sometimes figure out what there would be written, because if it's only a few letters or so, then you know. So, but then I put still a bracket and write those letters that I think would have been there, or even a few words if it makes an awful lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I write them there, and then with the transcription, you just go through all the documents of a certain volume.
So the purpose of the transcription, first of all, is just clarity of to get what is in the Dutch down clearly.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. So that it's easier to read, that you don't have to stare all the time, because there are different handwritings too. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of the documents are in very nice handwritings.
And even people who were born and raised in the Dutch language have a difficult time looking at the 17th century handwriting.
Yeah, they do, because the letters are sometimes written very differently. Like an E is nowadays very differently written, mm-hmm. and I think that it becomes harder and harder the more people start using typewriters or the computer and learn less how to write. you know, the old-fashioned handwriting. Mm-hmm. But it might become harder all the time. You do have to decipher words. And in the beginning, I was insecure with that. But now, of course, you get to know the styles of writing. But then you also have different people who write. Usually, those administrative papers that we translate, those are most of the time written by secretaries.
So it's a professional hand.
And those are very regular, and you can decipher them pretty easily.
And I remember you sitting and showing me a document that Stuyvesant wrote himself.
Oh,
and it was
goodness.
A very different kind.
Yes,
of
yeah. Yes. There are a few. And Stuyvesant is one of the worst. And it takes me forever to decipher it, uh-huh. even though I'm so used to it. By now, I've done this work for 30 mm-hmm. years, and I still am staring at those documents, and it's hard to figure it out.
And you know, there
are a few more people like
that,
too.
I was going to ask, because, you know, people, if you're a handwriting expert, you know different types of people based on handwriting, and you know some of these individual people, I imagine, from New Netherland, based on their handwriting. You recognize Stuyvesant's handwriting.
Oh, yeah, yeah, uh-huh. yeah, yeah.
And there are others?
And there are others. There was in Albany of... which I focused more on, on our Beverwijk at the time, there was a commissary of the fort. And he drank a lot, or his handwriting was sometimes really, really bad. It was very tiny. You would think that maybe he had been drinking. Sometimes it's almost a straight line. And the funny thing is, at some point you do get used to it, and then it's hard to get used to the other handwriting of the secretary again.
Interesting.
So yeah. If you work long enough with it, And I think being trained as a school teacher maybe helps too, uh-huh. because you see so many bad handwritings there too.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, so that's the transcription part, and then what's the next? How does the next steps in the process?
Well, then I give my transcription to Charlie, or whenever he's ready, and he translates it. And then after that's all done, there need to be annotations made. Sometimes something needs a note, or sometimes there is a part that has already been translated in the past, and in the document that we have, there is a part missing, then we can still use the translation from the past, mm-hmm. and put that between brackets.
And indicate
whose translation that is, mm-hmm. or where you got it mm-hmm. from. And then in the end, we index a volume. Mm-hmm. And so that people can use the translation and can search it very quickly, too.
Right. And part of the job of transcribing is you're leaving things blank in brackets where maybe it's torn off or something like that.
Yeah.
And part of the logic of that is that you might later, you or someone might discover what's missing, right?
Yeah. And with some of them, we actually were able to do that because they would always write three copies, one to keep here, one to send to the Netherlands, but there were two sent to the Netherlands actually, because a ship could easily be wrecked or whatever. anything could happen. So then would a copy go with another ship? And sometimes those copies are not exactly the same; they are spaced out differently over a page. So I've had a few volumes where I could fit it in, that you take the copy and you compare it with the document that I have already transcribed, and then you could fill in the missing words and mm-hmm. still get it mm-hmm. all together.
Uh-huh. And then the next step is, after translating, is indexing and then producing a published volume.
Yeah, and it needs an introduction, of course, still, so that you can kind of tell what it's all about, what the documents are, and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it has the biggest change over the years in how you work has to do, I guess, with computers?
Yeah, that was the biggest change, I would say that. Yeah.
And now all of them are being put online as well. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's the objective.
It's the idea is that all the documents will be put online, and then all the transcriptions, and all the translations. The transcriptions are all done now, that those are finished. And
for the whole corpus?
Yeah.
It's all finished. Yeah, it's all transcribed.
The transcriptions are all done. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so now I'm also only translating anymore.
Right.
And maybe when the transcriptions need to go online, I may want to look at it a little bit more, because I made them knowing that we would look at them again anyway for the translation. So then, yeah, you are not as precise probably as if you know that the other people are going to look at it. Then you're going to be more precise with it.
Mm-hmm.
But
Of the roughly 12,000 pages of material that we're talking about how much of it has been translated?
Boy, I saw somewhere maybe like 2/3 or so. I'm not sure. I would.
Uh-huh. I would think that you might have a little chart and you'd be checking things off as you go and get close
to
the end.
Yeah, but I. Oh, I'm sure we can figure it out very quickly, I don't know it out of the top of my head.
Sure.
I know that I've said in a talk sometime that 2/3 of it was done.
Mm-hmm. Your writing, is it, you were talking about Charlie initially asking you to do a little map or chart of Beverwijk. Is it fair to say that that became your dissertation?
Yeah. Yes, because, Professor van Deursen had asked me all the time to do a dissertation with him. That was at the Free University in the Netherlands. But I had no idea, because most of the time I was in the United States and I had no idea how to go about it in the Netherlands. Where do you go when somebody says you can write a dissertation for me? I had no idea, and I was only there for a short time. So at the time, and it was not really a high priority. I mean, I never had a desire to get a PhD in history, because Dutch was my great love, really. And but then van Deursen retired, and Willem Vrijhof succeeded him. And Willem I knew already from his own research here, because when I transcribed, I would see something in a transcription that some researcher was looking for something, and I thought, I would think like, oh yeah, this is something that this so-and-so could use. I would usually make a copy and put it in an envelope and send it. So I had contact with Willem for quite a while for his own research. And one day I opened up the newspaper, a Dutch newspaper, and I see a picture of Willem, life-size, just about, and saying that he had succeeded Professor van Deursen. And I sent him a note to congratulate him on it. And he said, well, you can do a dissertation with me. I said, and he had lived in France for a long time, so I think he knew what my problem was, how to go about it. And at some point I must have said, well, maybe I should do this. And he said, oh, I'll register you. So, and then I was kind of stuck, because now I was registered at Free University to do my dissertation with Willem. And it made sense, because I eventually came up with a plan of Beverwijk as far as I could make it. And it's certainly is not perfect. But then it's like, what's the use of a plan? I mean, the Fort Orange court minutes had already been published for a long, long time. And what are you going to do with just a map and saying so-and-so lives here? And in the meantime, I had made all these packets on these people that were living there. And it made sense to write a little bit more around it. And at the time, and that was also one of my things that motivated me, was that there were really not many people there that did anything on New Netherland. When I came here, Charlie was the only one who knew any Dutch. Jaap Schildkamp was the only one who had done and paid attention to New Netherland at the time. Now I'm talking about from 1960s or so. Mm-hmm. So there was really nobody there. And when I did the stuff on the poor relief, I still didn't know anybody who was looking at New Netherland at all. And now that's hard to imagine, mm-hmm. but nobody knew anything about
and
it.
And Willem Vrijhoff at the Free University and encouraged you to make that connection.
Yeah, because Willem ended up getting interested in New Netherland because he had written about an orphan child and then had kind of figured out that this orphan child ended up in New Netherland. So he ended up in New Netherland also kind of by coincidence. Mm-hmm. He never intended to. And so Willem understood the whole thing. And I think he also then realized how much information here was still and how much could still be done. So for me, it was also, we got so many questions from people coming because the project has the annual seminars, mm-hmm. right? The Rensselaerswyck seminars. And it would be always people asking, like, what was life like? Or how did they dress? Or what were the houses like? Or how did they learn in school? What was the system? How this, how that? And you try to answer, but I had to look it up all the time, mm-hmm. too. And I felt pretty dumb because Charlie knows all this stuff. And I always had to look it up, and then I forgot again. And then I thought, well, you know, it may not be a bad idea to just throw all this stuff together. And then people can read it, and they don't have to ask me anymore.
His simple question, draw up a chart, ended up being you doing a dissertation in which you're trying to flesh out what this community was, this Dutch community on there.
I think anything you just want to find about this community, you can find in it. There's so many little facts in it.
And, but, you know, something that what you touched on in talking about, this is one of the things I think is so fascinating and at the same time so infuriating about doing history is, as you said, it says in one record that so-and-so lives on the east, and then somebody else says he lives up to the west, and you're like, so there's, I always find that it's kind of like you have these little points, these little dots to work from, and you have to somehow connect these dots. Yeah. And how do you do it? And so in essence, what you were trying to do was connect the dots so that you had a kind of three-dimensional picture of what Beverwijk was.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Uh-huh. And
to back up and tell, you started to tell, just for orientation purposes, Beverwijk, Fort Orange, Rensselaerswyck, how did those things, it's very complicated, how did those pieces fit together?
Just a little bit of the history of this area, is that basically what
you mean?
Yeah,
and physically, what were those three different things?
Yeah, Rensselaerswyck was formed in 1629, 1630, and it was really an effort of the directors of the West India Company to populate New Netherland. And Rensselaer was one of several patroon ships, like what would you say in English, the seniority, and it offered people, because there were not enough people in New Netherland, you needed to, what the directors then in charge thought, you need to claim New Netherland. The English are there, so send out people to populate the area. And now I'm trying to think of too many things at the same time.
So Van Rensselaer was given an area of land. How big initially?
As big as the province of Gelderland. I could not even say that.
That's pretty big. This whole region, basically.
Yeah. That's what he bought.
The whole region around
the
Albany. Yeah. With the idea that he would then be responsible for bringing people to work at.
Yeah, what the patroon system held was basically at least these patroon ships and Rensselaerswyck specifically was like four people worked together. They all had one fifth share, and then the person who had two fifth share was responsible for getting the people here, for getting the tools and whatever you need to build up a community. So Killian van Rensselaer, who was one of the directors of the West India Company, he knew already beforehand that this was a very fertile area, and he chose for this area on the North River, on the Hudson River, the northern part, and that's where he sent the people. The other patroon ships that were settled at the same time, they were sold back to the company because there came another faction, other directors who kind of made it hard to send as many people and to do all the things that they were supposed to do. And Van Rensselaer did not want to sell it back to the company for, I think he wanted 6,000 guilders, and they did not want to pay that for it. So, and then he kind of kept working at it and organizing. And he did that until he died. He didn't get to 50 people there within the 4 years, but he had in 1642, there were some 100 people here, and in 1643 he died. And at that time, his oldest son was still too young to be the patroon, and the guardians of the new patroon decided that the village, the center of Rensselaerswyck, where he wanted all his people to live together, should not be, as Van Rensselaer had always said, on the east side of the river, opposite from Fort Orange. But they changed it, the location, and they put it right around Fort Orange. And, well, that was something that the company, especially Peter Stuyvesant, was not happy with. And that led to to Peter Stuyvesant eventually claiming the area within a cannon shot of Fort Orange and saying, well, this is not Rensselaerswyck anymore. People who come here, they can trade freely in beavers. And he gave it the name Beaverdijk, the district of the beaver.
Mm-hmm. So then you had the town of Beaverdijk.
Yep.
And you had the fort, and then all around it, you had Rensselaerswyck.
All around it, you still had Rensselaerswyck. So then both entities had had their own court, and it was interesting because Rensselaerswyck had its own court as well. And at some point they did get in trouble because the company wanted to have tavern keepers pay excise. And of course the patroonship refused to do that. And some tavern keepers who did refuse, they fled to the patroon's house, which was in Beaverdijk. But they had they were like an island almost in there. The company people could not catch those. So it was really like a seniority with its own governments. I'm not explaining.
And there's
this
a continual tension between these two jurisdictions over who has authority, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And then eventually, in 1652, the director who had been sent to New Netherland in order to have this center built around Fort Orange in 1648, Brand van Slichtenhorst, he kept building despite all the warnings from Peter Stuyvesant. And when he was eventually taken prisoner, second son of Kilian van Rensselaer, or at least a younger son, came over here, and then he kind of had to mend the whole thing again. And after that, well, they had to live peacefully together, and there were still some problems amongst each other, but they were able to kind of solve it more or less.
Jumping right ahead, 1664, the English take over, and Beaverdijk becomes Albany. But Rensselaerswyck stays.
Yeah, and it ends up in the manor, but I don't know anything about the manor.
Okay, but what I'm getting at is, in the English period, a lot of the town retains a lot of its original identity. Yes.
Yeah.
And you see that. How does it manifest itself? How does this stay a different place?
I think by people probably still keep speaking Dutch. Mm-hmm. They still have they keep a lot of the liberties that they had, especially after 1664 first. They did the poor relief, taking care of the poor. They did that for a long time the same way. If you look at Deacon's accounts books in the church, they kept speaking for a long time Dutch, 1795 or so even. And when people from the Netherlands in 1840 came over here, they were still able to speak with the older inhabitants here in Dutch. Mm-hmm. So the culture lingers on for a long time too. And it's so isolated up here north. It's so different from New York City that maybe that is also the isolation here for a long time made that also possible, that it still stayed pretty Dutch.
You said before that when you first came here, you never didn't realize that this was part of a Dutch colony. Mm-hmm. You knew about New Amsterdam, but you didn't know this.
No.
And I think most people, most Americans, would not know that either. But would you say that people in this area have some sense, some awareness of the Dutch heritage?
Oh, I think in this area they do. Uh-huh. I think this area, when I first came here, I mean, people would come to me and they say, oh, you're Dutch, you're from the Netherlands, I'm Dutch too. And uh-huh. I'd start speaking Dutch to them and they had no clue what I was saying, and I had no clue why they wouldn't speak Dutch if they were Dutch.
Right.
So,
Welcome to America.
Yeah, and then they were like descendants of somebody from Schleswig-Holstein or something.
Yeah.
But they
kept that awareness.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I was flabbergasted uh-huh. by that. I mean, me not knowing anything at the time, yeah. I was really surprised to hear so many people refer back to that.
Mm-hmm. So the second book on Killian van Rensselaer, what prompted you to write that? Why did you decide to devote a book to him?
Willem had said to me that my dissertation would become fatter than his book. On Evert Willems, and he said, "Well, it's going to be so thick. Maybe you should take a few chapters out."
Oh, so you were
out.
Including too much on van Rensselaer in your dissertation.
Actually, on Rensselaer's Wijk and that whole early period from 1614 was in there too, but so I had two chapters left, and by that time I was a lot more in the Netherlands too. After I finished my dissertation, I actually moved back to the Netherlands, and I thought maybe I should still do something more about Rensselaerswijk and I should do more research on it. But then I was in the Netherlands going to the municipal archives in Amsterdam a lot, and I found so many more things on Killian van Rensselaer that I thought, oh, I'm here in the Netherlands, it would be a shame if I don't just take advantage of that. Maybe I should just focus on Killian instead, because that is what sometimes people ask too, like, why did they leave? Why did they go here? And those kind of questions. And there was so much new stuff. But before I started working on van Rensselaer, Charlie and I would talk sometimes about him, not having one single idea whether he would be like a Maurits or an Oldenbarneveld supporter.
Mm-hmm. So basic thing, information about him were unaware of.
Yeah. There was I found a lot of new information, and at some point I found like love letters from him and love letters in the sense of then, and just telling why he would need to marry this and this woman. And it was just wonderful stuff. It mm-hmm. was just great stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I found a whole inventory of his house after his wife died, who died like, I think, 30 years later or so than he did. So in the 1670s. But it still, it was a beautiful inventory with all kinds of stuff. You know, he was a jeweler, mm-hmm. so there was all this jewelry stuff, but also how a house is divided and mm-hmm. Built, and because it would go from room to room, it would say what was in the blue kitchen, it would say what was in the zaal, it would say what was in this room and mm-hmm. in that room and in the basement. And here you have a description of a house and that he bought that lot right after the Keizersgracht was dug, you know,
in
1613 they started adding to the city and building the Heren and the or the Keizers and the Prinsengracht. And he bought lots there, like 4 or 5 lots. And you see a description of one of those houses there. I mean, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's brand new stuff. And so I got very excited about all of that. And then I thought maybe I really have to write more about him. Sure. And it'll give me a handle to answer questions like, why did they leave? And in the course of that whole process and that research, I found out who were, you know, who he was working with. I found a lot more about those people who he was working so closely with, about his network, and also about his political standing at the time. And then I discovered that the guy that he was associated with, who in a company for jewelry trade, that he became the admiral of a Nassau fleet. And that Maurits had changed his whole policy, really, the policy of the Netherlands to bring the 80-year war that was being fought then, to bring that after the truce, after 1621, to South America. Because that's where the enemy had the sugar plantations, and that's where they got the silver that financed the war for Spain. Mm-hmm. And I think Maurits, Kilian, was like a really staunch Maurits supporter. Mm-hmm. His father had fought in the army for him, and he had in that inventory there were also medals with you mm-hmm. know, that referred back to some of those things. So just seeing it in that light, then I also thought, like, you know, settling New Netherland, I mean, yeah, the beaver trade is nice, that's important, but there may be a much larger plan here that Maurits had and that Kilian believed in, that he would say, yeah, the Dutch always had their eyes on the silver fleet that would go once a year back to Spain, and they would collect somewhere, and they knew exactly when they would go. But going with the Dutch fleets to the Caribbean, where they would kind of sail around and so forth, waiting for this fleet to go, I mean, they only got that silver fleet once, and they wanted more. But being there, I mean, it's easy. The storms, the masts break, the damage on the ship or the provisions, and there are not enough provisions. So they would have to sail all the way back to the Netherlands, which if they did it in 6 weeks, it was fast. And if they would have settlements closer by, that would give them a lot more chances to get another silver fleet or a big chunk of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you see plans of those patroons, Blomaert, Van Rensselaer, Godijn, they had plans to have the Ile du Sable near the Canadian border, near Newfoundland, and as far down to Fernando de Noronha for the coast of Brazil. And they intended to build little settlements. New Netherland was not the only place where they wanted to settle and those patroon ships. No, Van Rensselaer was also going to be patroon of Ile du Sable or Sable Island. And I think it was Miguel Pau who also was going to be on Fernando de Noronha. Mm-hmm. And so they had these huge plans to have all these settlements here. So, and New Netherland was large, and there were woods there. There was fertile soil where you could grow grain, wheat, and so forth. You could make provisions for ships. So I think it seems to me that it would be part of that whole grand plan mm-hmm. that Maurits had and that Van Rensselaer went for. So when Van Rensselaer became the director of the West India Company in 23 or so, I think, his associate, Jacques Lhermitte, became the admiral of the Nassau fleet. So to me, it's like unbelievable. When 1624, what a year that must have been for them to be home in Amsterdam, and great news coming in, like, yes, Brazil is taken. We took Brazil. And And then there come all these great news things in of the Nassau fleet. Of course, a year later, Brazil was taken back by the Spaniards, and Jacques Lamita died in front of the coast of Lima. So, and it did not work out as well. But I just thinking about how those guys must have felt in those days, they must have felt on top of the world or something.
And they had this vast vision for conquering the new world.
I know. It's just so exciting to think of that they were doing this, and that they had the energy and they were willing to put all the efforts and money
into it.
And
this tiny nation, which isn't even really a nation yet.
No, it's just
has
seven
this
small
ambition
provinces.
To like swallow the
whole
North
world.
And South America.
Yeah. I think if... You know, I said before, like, I didn't like history all that much. But when you read about this stuff, I mean, how can you... That is so exciting. Sure. To me, it's like fascinating how people can... How they are involved in that, and they are going to change the world,
and
really.
And you uncovering that, in a sense, through Van Rensselaer, you're seeing this much larger ambition, and then you ultimately see it become diminished. They change their, they become more realistic. But no matter what you're doing in writing a book about him is writing about what, this scope of this life of someone who was an early molder of American colonial history, even though he never set foot here.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Do you have another book project?
No.
Okay. You're fine.
Okay.
What's the main pleasure that you take in your work?
I've always enjoyed working with Charlie because you can talk about it. He has a great sense of humor. So in some ways, it's just pleasant to work together. And I really feel sorry that we are on different floors now. But because that aspect is kind of gone, you can't, we don't really talk that much about, at least not as in the past. I also really love the documents and the whole adventure that it has taken me on. I would never, ever have expected that. I would never have expected that I would like it as much. I also am so surprised that just those simple documents that you can do so much with it. You can you can read it as a Dutch text, and you can read it as history. You can kind of plunge into it and learn more about the history. But now that I'm translating, and I also thought I never would like translating, and yet it. I really find that fascinating too. It just shows you the depth of a language and how it is alive, how it changes through time. And you know, sometimes there are people, a German who writes a letter or so. Or I have actually transcribed a letter too, and translated it, of a man who was taken prisoner by the Indians, and you can still see the folds in the document that he had it in a pocket somewhere, and then. It took like 9 days to go to Manhattan to Stuyvesant, but they are just full of life, really, those documents, and in many different ways, in history, but also just the language itself. I mean, it's miraculous. There are so many different languages that change through time, and that you and I can sit there and talk and understand each other. So I think that's what I pretty much like about it.
So growing up in Drenthe on the farm, you would never have imagined yourself having such an important role in this ongoing enterprise that has resulted in this broadening of awareness of this piece of American history, I imagine.
If anybody would have told me in the past, I would have said, you're nuts. I would never want to do that. And I want to be a farmer.
You wanted to be a farmer?
Yeah. As a child.
We'll end it there. Jannie Venema, thank you very much.
You're welcome.